was introduced to the one and only George Best, and life became seriously interesting then as a young single guy. Champagne was definitely on the list, and so was a lot of other bad habits. Rangers lost to Celtic in a League Cup final. That was a warning sign of how Rangers would respond under Gerrard and how Celtic would respond under Lennon. Bestie used to get paid £500 a day to go in there because the clientele, especially females that were coming in, would more than, you know, pay for George's time in there. My real choice should have been Liverpool. I mean, I spoke to Man United, Spurs, Inter Milan, Liverpool and Arsenal.
Hello and welcome along to another very special edition of the From the Horse's Mouth podcast. The January blues are upon some of us, but here to help them go away are Ruby Walsh and Paddy Power in conversation with Mr. Charlie Nicholas.
Good afternoon, Charlie. I'm very, very grateful for you to come and join us this morning. Myself and Paddy, we're needing a bit of cheering up and nothing better than a bit Scottish joy in our lives. So there is. But anyway, Charlie, of course, you are Champagne Charlie. Where did the nickname come from?
Well, to be fair, it was a pretty easy, as you can imagine, the media back in the early 80s. It was a fairly easy headline. You know, headlines when I scored a goal for Celtic was probably Charlie Bubbles, and then obviously leads on to Champagne Charlie. I think because I had a little bit of difference, not in the respect of being a normal 17-year-old guy from Glasgow, because all my mates, we dressed the same. We thought we were Bono from U2, and, you know, we had an earring and we didn't wear socks when we went out. And we thought we were trendy. We probably, you know, weren't, but we thought we were trendy. And because I was one of the few or first footballers to kind of do that, then the media started to probably impose themselves into giving me a kind of personality before I actually earned it. So I think that ended up with Champagne Charlie. And the reality of it, guys, is honestly, I was on £30 a week at Celtic when I played in the first team. So you work out how I could afford champagne at £30, and I had to give my mother £10.
Well, I'm too young, Charlie, to remember. Like, how much did a bottle of champagne cost back then in a nightclub? Or did you have to pay for anything?
Well, in Glasgow, you always have to go to a certain direction before you can get freebies, unlike Jack Charlton when he went to Ireland. But I wouldn't have a clue then. I mean, I wasn't even a beer drinker. You know, I was probably a little half a shandy man. I was bold because, you know, those days, I was still underage, so I couldn't get into the pubs, but everybody knew me. So I used to always have to pick certain aspects of my older sister at the time used to work in bars. So I used to always manage to get in the side door somewhere. But no, champagne was never on the list in those days.
It's kind of half disappointing. Like, I thought you were Champagne Charlie, you were burning at both ends, but it literally comes from what you did on the pitch, nothing to what you did off the pitch.
Well, I kind of tried to have a go at it in London, Ruby, when I went to Arsenal in 83, because then obviously I jumped from like £30 a week to, in fact, later on at Celtic, I went up to 90. But when I went to Arsenal, I ended up in 100,000 a year. So, you know, life changed a bit. And then I was introduced to the one and only George Best. And life became seriously interesting then as a young single guy. Champagne was definitely on the list, and so was a lot of other bad habits.
But it's something I was reading up before this, like, to see, like, you know, you were being compared to a young George Best coming through, and like you were the most sought after prospect in the whole of the UK when you did leave Celtic then in 83 and you went to Arsenal. And did it feel that way at the time? Was it just like, Jesus, I'm like a movie star when you arrived in London?
Well, I generally didn't have a clue how it would be, because I'd been to London once in my life, and that was to watch Scotland getting thrashed 5-1 at Wembley. So we were in, we were out, and it was a painful memory, obviously. But my real choice should have been Liverpool. I mean, I spoke to Man United, Spurs, Inter Milan, Liverpool and Arsenal, and I generally did feel that the prospect of me getting into the Liverpool team with Dalglish and Rush was virtually impossible. They were the best team on the planet. I did then fancy Manchester United because it was Manchester United, and probably when I was younger, my father was a night shift worker in the Daily Express as a printer, and that went bankrupt and we were asked to move to Manchester, and we probably should have. So I could have been a Manchester United player, but the reality of what understood is I was getting a lot of media coverage in Scotland, and I was starting to do things that I was getting, you know, put on the front pages rather than the back pages without the lifestyle thing. It was just, they made it more interesting than it seemed to me. But in London, it was a vast world. It was a whole new world. They were throwing 10 grand at you for doing adverts wearing skimpy underwear and different things. What the hell did I know? I didn't have an agent. I didn't have any understanding of life. And I took the agenda and just went for it. I didn't really have any experience. I didn't have any guidance. So it was fun. It was stupid. Lots of different things that they keep you right when you're older. And my daughters keep reminding me of the embarrassment that I put them through. But I had a great time. I don't deny that.
But then, so since you say you had no agent, because I was about to ask you about, who's advising you at that stage? Does it come down to wages, to money? Because, obviously, the London lifestyle is appealing and all that stuff you probably didn't consider before you signed for Arsenal. You're going to be getting 10 grand for getting into your jocks or whatever. But, say, Liverpool, is that you're just thinking, I just want to play football. I'm not going to get in the team with these two lads there. Yeah. So, knock them off the list. It's that simple.
There was an agent come in to negotiate the deal. God bless my ex-manager, Billy McNeil, was Celtic manager at the time. And Billy was more like a father figure to me than my manager, because he realised that, you know, when I was trying to negotiate with Celtic, that there was no negotiation. The board controlled the players then, unlike today. So basically, they didn't make me an offer. So it was either stay in 90 quid or, you know, in other words, move. We want to sell you. So I had no choice in the matter. So Billy brought in someone who could represent me in terms of the structure of the salaries in England. So we kind of used the guy to do that, but that was all. The ingredients for me making a choice was personally who I met with Liverpool. I mean, the one that put me off Manchester United was Ron Atkinson, because I met him and Martin Edwards, and I really did think I would have done the deal with Manchester United. But I wasn't overly impressed with the way that Ron was talking. Big personalities, you know, and, you know, started, you know, asking them questions like, where would I play? Would I play up front? I was expecting him to say myself and Mark Hughes would be the partnership. And he says, well, I'm not sure yet. I've not made my mind up. So that uncertainty kind of makes your mind up. And Ruby will remember Liam Brady, who was an Arsenal legend. Liam went to Italy, and when I met Arsenal with Don Howe, they were talking about signing Ray Wilkins from Chelsea and bringing Liam Brady back. And I thought, that style might suit me if Arsenal are going to change. And of course, I mentioned the fact that how do you get into the Liverpool team when Rush and Dalglish are up front? It was virtually impossible.
Do you think players now, Charlie, put as much thought into the moves they're making as you did into that move? You were thinking of making a move, not on financial grounds, on where you were going to play. Do you think the players nowadays make the same decisions, put as much thought into it?
I think if only maybe the very top ones are the youngsters, like when I was 21, that was when Celtic were selling me. I think we are 17, 18, and the people that represent them now, Ruby, have a different prospect because they have got remarkable coverage. Some of them have too many agents and some of them have too much advice, and that can be problematic. I think the first foremost, a lot of the agents, and not them all, is the financial package. And I think sometimes the players can fall into that trap rather than, will I get a game? Or how long is it going to take me to get into the team? But I think the top players can pick and choose now, and I think it's too easy for them. And it is. The majority of people, I would say, when we look at footballers now, it's about the financial rewards rather than anything else. I mean, I'll give you an example of how I think football's going the wrong way. Ozil, who's a fabulous footballer, is stuck at Arsenal on 200-odd grand a week. You know, if it was me and I wasn't playing, I would want to go and play somewhere. They've made a fortune. They're worth unimaginable amounts of money. And it's just, if that's the agenda that's setting the tone for the youngsters coming through in the game, I think it's wrong. And I think it's time that some of the advisors within these guys who look after these guys started to understand there has to be a bit of common ground that footballers can understand. It's not just about the money or joining a club. Some of them join a club when they know they can't even get in the team. And what's the agenda in that? Learning and being patient and going on loan, like Chelsea have done with 25 players. Yeah, it's went the wrong way, and I think it's time that some advisors started to get to the guys who said, this is about playing, this is about enjoying the game again. And I think then people, the normal people, the working class, as we would probably still call them, would understand football a little bit more.
Read this morning where Ozil is going to Fenerbahce, I think, which would probably be a relief for Arsenal to get him off their books. But you could have went to Spurs as well. What swung you Arsenal's way over Spurs? Was it just literally Liam Brady coming back and what you saw the future in Arsenal?
Well, Spurs were actually the first team in. They were in 6 months before my contract ended. And back then it wasn't you could sign an agreement in January. You couldn't do that. You had to wait until the contract had ended. So I spoke to Celtic has spoken to Spurs and accepted a fee. And I think it was a set agenda of something in the region of 600 grand. And because of that, they were then told that they would be kept informed and the contact would be made later on. But I think Spurs had issues trying to sell one or two players and ended up dropping out in the balance of it. I think they had Alan Brazil, Steve Archibald and Gav Crooks up front. And I think they were looking to sell one or two. And in the end, they couldn't get anybody out the door. So they kind of just fell by the wayside. I have to say now, being an Arsenal man, that it wouldn't have been Spurs anyway.
When you landed in London, all right, you're from Glasgow, but did you feel daunted? Who showed you around? Who looked after you? Did you feel, whoa, I'm a young lad in a big city. How do I cope here?
Well, I have to admit, they put me in fabulous digs, which was a country club. Which was maybe the wrong digs that Arsenal should have put me in. And they gave me the key to the bar so I could come and go when I pleased. That was not a good idea, I have to admit. But, Ruby, like, you know yourself, when you're a young professional, the one thing you love being with players. I mean, you're being competitive against fellow jockeys, but with your teammates and everything is about, you're still competitive with each other, getting fitter, being quicker, whatever. And I loved training, and I was a real hard trainer. When I was at Arsenal, I found it tremendously lonely. Most of the players were married. I was very single and wanted to live a bit. They stayed maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes drive from where I was staying. So that was difficult. I mean, players who probably looked after me best was Graham Ricks, who was very good towards me. He'd been at Arsenal since he was a kid from Doncaster. David O'Leary, Pat Jennings. I think the Irishness of these guys was making you feel at home, come for dinner, see the wife, see the family. So they were all great guys, but when you finish a game on a Saturday and they're going home to their families and you're wanting to go out with no real friends, to be honest, it's a dangerous game and it's also a very lonely place. So it probably took me the best part of 9 months in reality for me to actually understand what London was meaning to me. And understanding where I was going. And that's obviously why, for some reasons, I started to go in the wrong direction in terms of professionalism.
Funny, I love the way you say, you didn't just say you were single, you were very single.
I was very single.
But anyway, the difference between today and, like, I mean, this is typical of me to be so frivolous about stuff, but one of the big differences today, the players live very much in the public eye, you know, and you can't go and get the paper without someone sticking a camera phone on your face and all that. Like, back then, I'm sure there's VIP rooms and clubs and all that kind of, like, glamorous stuff, but was it easier to have, like, I remember I've talked to, like, do you remember Bob Cass? Full of stories, poor old Bob, but full of stories about back in the day before, I don't know, the News of the World, I think, ruined it all, but before when the media used to travel with the teams and it used to be stories of the journalists going to lash with the players after matches and all the kind of what goes on tour stays on tour. So in many ways, like, self-made, but the players today have it more difficult in one way, although they're much better rewarded. But I guess you just kind of lifted the covers a bit there on the loneliness that there can be. Like, did you mix them with players from other clubs as well or what?
Yeah, we did at times. Like, touching on that, Paddy, we in Scotland had a great representation from the written press that they would travel with us a lot and whatever stayed in tour was locked in there. And you could trust them. And if there was any news stories that was coming from them, I mean, as I mentioned, my dad worked in the newspaper industry, so he would always hear rumours that were going about different stories. And the sports guys would always kind of try and kill the stories if they could. So we could be open with them. We could have a relationship with them. I still think some of the modern-day players could have that, but you obviously have to have trust in both ways. But you never really get that now. And I found when I went to England, it was exactly, I could see that's where it was going. because I didn't really have a relationship with any of the big time and big time London Fleet Street guys were the big storytellers, and they were hard hitters. So I never really found I had much relationship in terms of a social relationship with these guys. Not that I didn't trust them, I just didn't know them. So yes, it has changed. You know, I mean, I don't play social media because I think it's dangerous for people like me. And I don't think you can always speak from the heart sometimes, which I like to do in these type of opinion pieces and one little column and what I did in Sky. I think sometimes now people can dress it up and twist it whatever way they can if they don't want to listen to the full package. And I think that's where the modern day player doesn't trust. But, you know, there's other side of things that the current day players are missing out in an education with their people. And I think we always said that. My great teachers in my younger days was Celtic's Lisbon Lions. Those guys who are left of them still talk like as if they're street guys. The people in the street don't just applaud them in the back and pat them in the back because they won the European Cup. They pat them in the back because they're real people. They talk their language. And unfortunately, the modern-day players don't speak the language of the normal people. Some do, but the majority don't because they don't really want to socialise with that type.
Do you think, I was almost got out before it, but do you think you were lucky in a sense to have been before phone cameras and social media and where you can't go to the shop but someone's taking a picture of it? Do you think you got to enjoy life more because of less technology in your era?
Yeah, I think I would have been probably exposed quite badly. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that because, as you know, mobile phones and whatever gadgets they can get. Yes, absolutely. No doubt. I could never have lived the way I did then. I mean, I used to go into George Best at a share in a pub in London called Blondes, believe it or not. I mean, I know that will surprise you, but and it was two guys from Manchester. And Bestie used to get paid 500 quid a day to go in there because the clientele, especially females that were coming in, would more than, you know, pay for Georgie's time in there. So you can imagine the media just having a frenzy in there with the mobile phones and just watching George. And George was a shy man and a very humble guy, but, you know, they would expose you for whatever way that you can. I mean, it was about a year or 2 years ago, we were sitting at the bar for Soccer Saturday on a Friday night, myself, Jeff Sterling, Tomo, and Chris Kamara. And Cammy was into his Twitter, and he says, oh, Wayne Rooney's just tweeted, and I was curious, and I said, well, what does he tweet on a Friday night? He says, good night. And I said, what does he say on a Saturday morning? Good morning. I mean, it's ridiculous that these people follow these things. So I would have been trapped big style, and I would have been trapped very quickly. But I suppose maybe like everything else, with your teachers, your fitness gurus, you know, there's a staff of 20 people behind the scenes that look after footballers personally, psychologists, that you would have to toe the party line and understand it. So I would have probably been modernised, but I would have been caught sharp.
We'll move on to today. And look, it's not been a wonderful season, Charlie, for your two clubs. Although Arsenal, we'll start with them, have slightly turned the corner in the last couple of weeks. I mean, before Christmas, there was talk of a relegation battle. I think that's been well and truly put to bed with their last couple of results, whatever, since they beat Chelsea. But are they still underachieving?
Yeah, they're still underachieving because they have a lot of good players. They have, in my opinion, a very talented young manager, stroke coach, who's learned from the very best. He knows the club inside out. There's still problems at boardroom level for me. I think there's too much influence that agents can bring in certain players or accommodate certain players because of the agency is close to the board. That shouldn't be the case. The board should have its own discipline and its own control. And its control should be led by not Arteta being like Wenger and controlling every detail, but having a very strong input in what he requires. The positives are, Ruby, that we've got some very good young players, Martinelli and, of course, Saka. The others are good players, but not quite top drawer. Aubameyang will get his goals. I've always been a fan of Lacazette. But we've tried to ruffle up a style because we've had massive problems defensively. And we still have massive problems defensively. And until Arteta can get rid of, you know, the aspects of people like, no disrespect for him, and it's not personalised, it's only my opinion. But Mustafi, I think even Bellerin's been weak since he had a bad injury 2 years ago. We have problems centre-back way. I mean, Saliba is just going to Nice and loan. Why did we buy him for 40-odd million? Xhaka is a good player, but it frustrates the life out of most people that support Arsenal because he always gives silly free kicks away, which is his defensive discipline. And we have a problem with that. But I think we're good enough to start threatening the top eight again, which is not a big success, but it's a positive because I think in time, given Arteta time, Arsenal will gradually creep back, but they need a clear out. They need to get rid of five or six players that have been sitting in there and too many chances for far too long.
It sounds, listening to you, that you're happy enough that Arsenal went with Arteta and didn't maybe go away to Mourinho or someone like that.
No, Mourinho's not a style that I enjoy. Do I enjoy his success? Absolutely. You know, he's got a magnificent CV, and why should I be saying that that wouldn't be the case for me? But, you know, I think when you're passionate about your club and you like a certain style, then you have to stay and believe that that style is true. After 20-odd years of Arsene Wenger and the success that we had under the greatness of him and the players that he created, the image that he created globally, and I have to say that we have to continue that. Just like, I know it doesn't feel like it now, but for Barcelona, when they had Cruyff, how they continued the Cruyff regime under Guardiola, and it's suffering a bit now. But Arsenal has to be the same as that. It has to keep its standard like that. And I think it has to keep its style like that. And I think Arteta fits the style.
You, go on, Paddy, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, with Wenger, so it's kind of clear where you stand on that, because I'd be more of the view that maybe Wenger's created some of these problems. Like he walked away leaving a big pile of shite behind him. And I mean, I know there's a lot of pressure for him out. And I saw he was quoted recently as saying, like, well, if I was required, of course I'd come back. And would you welcome that? Or do you think that's a step backwards? And more generally, actually, the thing that's always in my head whenever I speak to ex-footballers, like, it just seems to make no sense to me how the fans, they never really get in the back of the players. They just get in the back of the manager all the time, just blame the manager all the time. And I just find that really weird.
Yeah, and your first point, Arsene Wenger, I suggested about 2 or 3 years ago they should bring him back. Because when Arsene Wenger and David Dean were a partnership that was bringing in Thierry Henry's and Patrick Vieira's, it was a partnership that the manager wanted. But of course, he was a business structured idea because he was too intelligent for football, probably, that he wanted to have a say in the true finance of it. Whereas David Dean says, if we can afford it, we're just going to get you the player. And that's how the relationship worked. And it worked an absolute treat. So I would have taken him back. He's not a threat to Arteta. He's there to help. I think he is a genuine Arsenal fan. And because of that reason, he'll show leadership and he'll show understanding to it. And if Arsene Wenger was to turn on the phone or to turn up to meet a so-called player from Atletico Madrid or Barcelona or Real Madrid, I think there's a strong chance that Arsene Wenger could get the deal over the line because of his presence and his reputation. So I would have welcomed him back, and I still would. I still think he could play a marvellous part in teaching Arteta the real rules of the game. And of course, he made a lot of mistakes, and we inherited some of the bad signings that Arsene had made. But listen, Alex Ferguson made some mistakes, and he was the best ever. So it happens to him, but I think what he created, we have to respect. In terms of the fans, yeah, I get your point totally, but we did have a period of time, if I'm talking about Arsenal and principle, that when Arsenal fans get grumpy and they were threatening to lose out in the top four, and they'd been there, what, 21 years in a row, they started to pick in certain players. And Aaron Ramsey was one of them. And I was a massive fan of Ramsey. And I kept thinking, you'll end up squeezing this guy out the door, he'll leave, because he won't feel appreciated and he's one of our top players. So they do find a way. But believe me, it's never usually the foreign players. It's usually a British player of some description that tends to get the hits more than anybody else. It's just the way of it. It's always been that way. It's maybe softened a bit, I think, because we've got such an international and global following of football fans that turn up at stadium now that they're just grateful sometimes to be there. So the first point of interest for the blame game, the modern day blame game, tends to be the manager, and that's why they don't survive too long.
You speak pretty highly of Arsene. Did you know him personally?
No, I only met him once, and it was very briefly. Didn't really get the chance of a long conversation. I've always said, you know, like Ruby, in my time as a kid growing up and not really getting the experience, or certainly not getting kind of guided, if you like, that I'd love to have had one or two seasons under Wenger, just to, for fitness-wise, because I love my training so much. So fitness was never really a problem for me, unless, you know, I started to think I wasn't going to be in the team much, and that unprofessionalism would come in because of the weakness in my head. And I don't think Wenger would have been like that. I think Wenger would have been constantly at me, like, technically you're good, but you must work in this and you must work in that. And I think he would have educated me better, and I think appreciated the game probably better.
I was in the Highbury one night, sorry, Paddy, and as a United fan, watch United play Arsenal, and Thierry Henry lost the ball, and to watch him track all the way back to retrieve it, the fitness that he had. And I remember thinking, yeah, God, what is Arsene Wenger instilling in these players?
Yeah. I think that was the thing when you look back in those type of moments. I mean, I would never have even blinked about trying to chase someone back. It just wasn't me. And that's when I started to see these habits that he started creating in players who were superstars, but yet they were giving them something back without the ball. And that's what real teamwork became, the modern-day teamwork, rather than going to the pub and having a laugh together and thinking you were all mates together and you would suffer and socialise together. He modernised it, he changed it. And I think, I mean, I know you're Man United, and that's what Fergie did when he first came in. The wonderfully talented Paul McGrath, who was with Gordon McQueen, he used to, on a Sunday, go to Manchester Airport for a couple of drinks because it was the only bar that was left open on a Sunday afternoon. And Fergie came in and started to change that mentality. You could still have a beer, but you can't leave yourself open to ridicule for certain. And I think Wenger was the main one to change and transform how players understood it. And that's why I speak so highly of him, because although it wasn't in my nature to do those type of things that he was teaching, I'd love to have heard what he had to say and tell me the truth, probably.
The fact that this year it looks like we might have a proper, maybe just because it's COVID year or whatever, we might have a proper title race, like a load of clubs in it. I know Arsenal probably aren't going to be one of them this year. But would that give you a little bit of faith that the ground isn't so far to make up for Arsenal in the coming seasons, that they might be able to challenge? Or do you think you mightn't see another title yet?
No, I think in time, I can't guarantee a title. No one can. You know, Liverpool couldn't until last season do that also. I can see them getting really close again. I don't think it's problematic at Arsenal. The problems have been defensive for 7-8 years. Wenger couldn't solve it, and that's why he had to go. Emery couldn't solve it, that's why he had to go. So I think Arsenal will always have fine players, and the academy's always been strong at teaching players in an attacking format of the game and understanding that side of it. It's the other side that we haven't learned. And I think, you know, if you've got a problem with a car and it's one thing that you need to fix to make it as good as what it was again, that's how I see Arsenal. I see Arsenal fix the defence, get the right people in, and Arsenal will go forward again and be challenging, because I think you're right. I mean, unfortunately, this pandemic has been such a brutal thing for us all in the world. But for football, it's been a come down in terms of the finance and what they can afford and who's going to buy who and who's going to move where, just because of the financial strains that's now on every club. So a lot of them have been dragged back down, which means Arsenal are back in the ball game. That's why they could go for 3 or 4 players last summer. So yeah, I expect that. If Arsenal are not challenging, Paddy, in the next 18 months, the owner will have to disappear. He will have to move on and give it to somebody else. That's where Arsenal are at. And whether it's with Arteta or it's someone else, but if it's not with Arteta and this current board, and they're not challenging, and not this season, but next season, if they're not challenging for the Premier League or for the Champions League, this owner has to step aside and sell it on.
That's great.
You know, I know that's dangerous.
I love that. We blame the players. If that doesn't work, we blame the manager. If that doesn't work, we blame the owner. And if that doesn't work, we just take up tennis.
Yeah, we do. But, or golf.
Either or.
Here at Paddy Power, we want our gambling to be fun and encourage our customers to bet responsibly. That's why we offer a number of tools to help you stay in control, including the ability to set deposit limits, get reminders after a certain amount of time playing, and to take breaks. For more information, visit responsiblegaming.paddypower.com. 18+ begambleaware.org.
I think we'll go back north of the border, back up to Scotland. Charlie, have Rangers just been good or are Celtic poor?
It's been a bit of both, if I'm fair, and that's not trying to neutralise it. Celtic have gone backwards. The signings have been poor. I think they were lazy about the signings. They've a certain element that the board control the budget, which is fair enough. It's been that way for a long time. But what happened about just over a year ago was Rangers lost to Celtic in a League Cup final and Rangers bossed the game and came away with nothing. And that was a warning sign of how Rangers would respond under Gerrard and how Celtic would respond under Lennon. And I think what's happened is that the ownership has thought that Rangers don't really have that much money. How are they going to make it that much better? And the ownership, to be fair to them, have said, we'll allow 15, 16 million quid to be spent. Now, people think that's fine and that's fair, but then it's down to the manager and the staff to do the job to make sure that the signings you're bringing in are better or it's making your squad stronger. And that's what Gerrard's done. He's hardly spent any money on defenders, and yet I think they've let in 5 league goals this season. They are brutal at the back. They are not a fabulous footballing side. In fact, when they beat my team Celtic the last twice, the strikers even haven't played well. But they've bossed the last 2 or 3 games. Celtic should have won in the 2nd of January, but we can't put the ball in the net because they're strong defensively. So there's a bit of both. I hold Celtic guilty because I thought they got lazy in the type of players that they require. They needed strong centre-backs. They needed full-backs. And they didn't get them in until late. And of course, up front, we've been relying on keeping Edouard happy, who's a fabulous player, and we'll eventually sell him. So there's been problems at Celtic, and Neil Lennon's been chopping and changing the style and the personnel, and it's caught up with them. Whereas Gerrard's been ruthless, tight defensively, solid midfield, will nick a few goals up front, because Celtic Rangers will dominate the other teams domestically. But Celtic's faltering, for me, it's not always... The domestic situation has been fabulous for Celtic fans, and it's a major success story. But Celtic's level of interest should be at Europe. That's where they made their reputation. That's where their reputation lies in greatness. Not just domestically. That helps. But they've let the standards drop. Whereas Rangers have raised the bar in Europe, which means domestically they gather momentum. So there's a bit of both. And I have to hold my hands up and say that Rangers have been by far the most consistent and better team.
Are the fans correct then to be protesting against Neil Lennon?
They're correct in protesting against him. Some of the protests have been way over the top. The personal stuff is, you know, it doesn't fit with me. So then they'll go to the board and say to the board, you fell asleep at the wheel, they've been accusing him of. And I think there is a little bit of that. You know, these guys try and stay on top of it. And they've been on top of it for so long. You know, my problem with Celtic still stands the same. You drop your standard when you start stopping thinking about Europe standards. And I know Brendan Rodgers took a couple of major hits and he didn't do it well. But I think that was part of the reason why Brendan said, if you're not prepared to back me and support me, I have to get out of here. Whereas Neil's a bit like, he would accept it a bit more readily because he was at Hibs. He didn't have a job. He's a Celtic icon. I don't dismiss that at all. But I think the reality is they got it wrong. The standards have dropped and they've got it wrong. Whereas Rangers have caught them up and now we're in real danger. I've not admitted the title to Rangers yet. I mean, I'm probably a fool for saying that because they've got to go to Aberdeen this weekend and that's a tough game for Rangers. And if they win that, it'll be their title. I don't see Celtic any way back. And it's going to end up being a real sad season for Celtic.
So for Celtic to turn it around, is it just to be as ambitious as thinking of Europe and that will help get them back on top in Scotland?
I think that's where the standards lie for me. Maybe I have, you know, so when I was brought up with Celtic, the original 9 in a row, when we were winning European Cup. We should have won a second in 1970 against Feyenoord, the Lisbon Lions. And then they lost their way and other guys had to come in and fit in. Now, they weren't as good as the Lisbon Lions, but they were up to a standard that we were good enough to keep beating a strong Rangers and a strong Aberdeen. And, you know, it was a strong league then. And we eventually lost it because we just didn't have the players who were good enough. But the standard in Europe was still very high. And I think when Celtic set the standards really high, it's hard to catch them. But I think just because everybody's been blinkered with 10 in a row, the quadruple treble, which was a magical achievement. But it's now, when you lose a league and it's looking likely, then people will say in 10 years' time, yeah, it was marvellous then, but they didn't get 10. Whereas if they say, well, in Europe, again, we're starting to beat teams that we should be beating and we should be challenging and taking on. I've been there when we beat AC Milan, we beat Juventus, we beat Barcelona. I mean, it was scary. They were fabulous, fabulous nights and the place was jumping and bouncing. And the ownership must have been saying, this is reality. This is where we belong. And it is where they belong. And I would just like to see them pinpointing where they should be again to start building this. Because if you don't win 10, then it's a rebuild. And that's where I would like the standards to be back to. And if they were to go after that type of standard and that outlook again, then I truly believe I would be supporting them if that was the case.
Do you think Gerrard is the reason for Rangers' resurgence as well? And just like, it must be because he doesn't have a massive kind of heritage with the club or anything like that. Surely this is a stepping stone to the Premier League for him. So do you think, like, if Rangers go on and win the league, that Gerrard will jump ship straight away, or do you think he'll try and build something at Rangers?
No, I've got the feeling he might stay around for a couple of years. Predominantly, it's his success. I mean, the ownership has backed him, but then the ownership has backed Neil Lennon. So the ownership has backed him, but he's went into the market. And he's modernised the club because he's brought in a new scouting system, a modern version, because he's not far off from retirement as a player. And his standards at Liverpool were stunning. He learned under Klopp. He learned under Dalglish. He learned under Hulé. You know, he's been a fabulous, iconic player, but he's also learned. He also looks as if he's got a ruthless streak within him, that if you don't do it for him, he'll be right down on top of you. I also think there's a discipline within, although when he plays Morelos, I think that discipline can disappear. But he's shaped a team that is predominantly well-drilled. It's been 18 months of drilling this technique into their defence. I mean, at the weekend against Celtic, his two best players were 38-year-old goalkeeper McGregor and 36-year-old Stephen Davis. You know, I mean, that tells you that he's got something that fits into a system that suits him. And he's only going to make it stronger, in my opinion, and that's why Celtic will have to play catch-up a little bit. But he's just going about his business. I mean, people are saying that he's the next guaranteed replacement for Klopp. That may be the case, but I could see Klopp being at Liverpool another couple of years. I don't think it guarantees Stevie Gerrard the job, just because if he was to win the title at Rangers, that he could walk into Liverpool. I think sometimes that's hard. That's tough. Look at Frank Lampard walking into Chelsea. So these things are difficult. As a Celtic man, I would like him to go to Liverpool this summer, but I don't see it happening. I do think he'll be about for another couple of seasons, unless something dramatic does change things.
If you're advising Stevie Gerrard, would you tell him to stay in Rangers for a couple of years, or would you advise him to go to somewhere else in England before he gets that Liverpool job? Because whatever way you look at it, Charlie, that Liverpool job will be his at some stage.
As a Celtic man, I would say go now, but you know, as a professional, a guy who thought he was a fantastic footballer, I would say he can sit tight. You know, I think when you learn, I spoke to King Kenny Dalglish on many occasions, and he was fortunate to get that job. But when he got the Liverpool boot room job, he was surrounded by masters who'd been about the club a long time. So he'd always said that he felt ready and he knew there would be problems. But because those masters were already there, he knew that he could go to them, and he had to have a true belief of being a listener rather than the controller. And I think because he had that, that was ahead of its time. But I think just to bring in your own personal guys now and to start trying to be on the front foot and start afresh, it's different. It's different. You get respect when you walk in. Frank Lampard gets it. I'm sure Arteta gets it. But you've got to prove it over a period of time that the players buy into you. And then when the ones you're leaving out get a little bit moody, how do you solve that problem? So, no, I see Gerrard personally not being in a rush to go anywhere right now. I think he's sitting tight. I think he's at a big club. He's doing building his reputation in Europe very well. And I think if he sits tight, he'll probably be ready to say, when Klopp is ready to go, I am your replacement.
Back to your playing days, Charlie, for a sec. It's such a big rivalry, the Old Firm rivalry. Like, what was it like when you playing in one of those matches? I mean, was that your whole season? You just look forward to these. Like, I know as if you're a fan of Scottish football at all, like, that's the one match you really care about when you're watching. You're looking on, you see there's a big one built up on Sky and all that kind of thing. But to play in them, was it just different?
It was totally different. It really was. It was, like probably being a top race at Cheltenham where the jockeys are Ruby many times have been on a favourite and APs maybe, you know, sitting close to him and probably another five or six jocks are sitting there ready to go with big time racers. You're nervous, your butterflies in your stomach are going. People were physically sick in the toilet before kickoff because of the nerves can take you different ways. Certain players would be, for instance, my type of personality, I needed to try and get a touch very quickly so that I could feel as if I was into the game. Well, it was a good touch or a bad touch. You just needed to get into the involvement. But it's quite dramatic because you can be 5 yards away from your teammate and you can't hear them. You can't hear any instructions. So your captain, who might be 50, 60 yards away, was irrelevant. You know, there was all kind of hand signals and daft, stupid things that you were trying to accommodate yourself. But you ended up in a land of your own in these games because predominantly when I came into these games in the early 80s, we had 90,000 in the stadium. And Rangers at Celtic Park would have 30,000 and Celtic would have the other 60. So it was nothing but noise and it was isolation. And it was then about being selfish. You had to personally look after your own self and your game to then try and have the confidence or the belief to fit into the team structure. And that's why probably individuals sometimes become the match winners. Or the individual sometimes get lost. The first ever derby at Ibrox, there was high hopes for me. And in 65 minutes had gone, my number went up and I was subbed. I don't remember anything about the 65 minutes. It was just a blur. And then my second game, a home debut at Celtic Park, we won 3-1 and I scored 2. And I remember every minute of it. It's just, it's weird. It's the most terrifying encounter you want to be involved in, but it's the most dramatic encounter you want to be involved in. And this is not being disrespectful, but I played in the North London Derby. It was very, very tame compared to the Glasgow Derby. Very tame. I loved those derbies also, but they were tame, believe me.
So you mentioned North London derbies, you've Ibrox, Celtic Park, but then what was it like playing at Hampden Park for Scotland? And a bit of an awkward question, but how come you only got 20 caps for Scotland?
I loved it. I mean, at the time, the players who I was coming into the national team were my heroes. King Kenny Dalglish was my hero, and I ended up playing up front with him that night in my debut against Switzerland. Souness was there. Danny McGrain was a father figure at Celtic with me. You know, people like Gordon Strachan were in the team. They were icons of the game for Scotland. They'd made tournaments, and they were, the Liverpool players especially, were the kings of Europe. So I loved it. Scoring my debut and playing with King Kenny was dramatic. I wouldn't say I was the most patriotic guy in the world in terms of, did it mean more to me than playing for Celtic? No, I wouldn't say it did. I loved representing my country, but I knew it would be probably a bit of a battle for me to always stay in the team because I think my style was a bit more individualist, probably more European in terms of technical, rather than the hard-working grafting guy that I think we were kind of, expecting. And I think when Kenny Dalglish and people were starting to fade out, then it was going to be harder for somebody like me to represent the new modern type scenario. Alex Ferguson became temporary manager when Jock Stein passed away. We had the World Cup together in Mexico in 86. I had 6 weeks with Fergie, and it was absolutely majestic. He was brilliant. He was a brilliant man himself. We didn't get the hairdryer treatment, but we got enough of the eyes and the finger came out. And if he ever said to you, well done, that was the biggest compliment you could ever have got off of Fergie. So I had a great 6 weeks with him. Learned a lot. I was hoping he was going to be Arsenal manager, but he went to Man United. And after that, there was a change of style. New modern coaches came in, and it was all about team formation and formats and second balls, which meant there was no real room for me. I think I started maybe 7 games for Scotland. The rest were substitute appearances. It was 20 caps, Ruby. I like to think I should have got more, but I got the same as Alan Hansen, and that's not a bad name to have to be equal with.
That's a fair one. Yeah, that's a good one. You can put that on your gravestone whenever that happens. I got the same amount of caps as Alan Hansen for Scotland. That would definitely read very well. But after the final game in the World Cup, Fergie absolutely ripped into Uruguay.
Yeah,
is that well, he brought that to Manchester United as well? Was that what was so good about him? That ability just to attack.
He was so focused, such a focused guy. I mean, we were in the build-up. We went to Santa Fe to acclimatise for the heat in the build-up to Mexico. And they worked us hard. They trained us hard. And when you're high altitude, the breathing and everything. So he got his fit. But he was taking us out for meals and he was showing his kind of man management skills in terms of that. Walter Smith and Archie Knox, who had regular partners with him. But it was an understanding within training that you had to give everything. Every training session was physical, demanding, win, have a laugh, mock the people that you beat. And that was still the amount of being, you know, really in there. Yeah, the Uruguay thing was something that it was built up because we'd never made the next stage of the World Cup. So he was sitting in a legendary status to say, I'm only temporary manager, but it'd be lovely for me to get through here. Now, we were in the group of death, you know, we had to play Denmark first, who were one of the best European sides. We lost 1-0 and we were unlucky. Then Germany only beat us 2-1. We were a bit unlucky against them. And if we would have got probably a point, it could have been enough for us to get through. But Uruguay were the most brutal team I've ever seen in my life. I was on the bench recovering from an injury, and they were absolutely brutal. And people like Souness, who was left out, I think, that day, with no one capable of kind of standing up and taking them on. And I think that upset Fergie more than anything else, that we couldn't see them off the way that they went about the game. It was brutal football. And although Fergie was a winner through and through, he would never went to those levels to have accommodated a winning formula. He was a great believer of that. And I think what Man United seen after that was such a determined individual to say, if someone wants to come and physically take us on, we'll be ready. And I think that was something else he learned from the World Cup.
It's funny, I read somewhere that Jim Leighton said the Uruguayans were pulling his bollocks during corners. Anyone drop a hand on you when you came
out? That sounds a tweet. No, I just remember them being brutal because, you know, Uruguay, South American teams were always tough. Everybody thought, you know, Brazil and Argentina, the lovely footballers. Of course they were. But they were always brutally tough. They were physically tough because that's just the way they were. No, they were no soft touches. You couldn't roll them over. But we just felt that they had no interest at all in getting the job done. But they got the job done because they qualified. They knew the pressures that was on it. And they probably had more pressure in their homeland than we did. So in a way, we could understand that later on. But I think it was just the fact that maybe in reality, we thought we were as tough as them. And it proved to be that they probably weren't. It was just that they had this hunger, this desire. No matter what the consequences were, they were never going to give up. And Scotland had probably a reputation throughout the world of being quite a hard physical side. And it proved in that day that we probably didn't cope well enough.
You were just lacking Sir William Wallace, by the sounds of it. He was the man.
Yeah, we should have painted our faces, I think.
Yeah, that would have been the way forward. Blue and white and all would have done. Anyway, Charlie, the real reason we have you here is to answer Paddy's three questions. He's been thinking weeks of these. He's been really excited. First of all, Charlie, do you want to go jump or flat?
Well, to use racing parlance, Charlie, I've got three easy questions which would be over the flat, or three harder questions that'll require a bit of honesty and soul searching, which would be over the jumps. So if you want, you can just take the jumps on, or you can say flat, because I don't actually have any flat questions. I'll ask the jump ones anyway. So
I would tend to go to the jumps, because when I went to Leopardstown a few times to watch Ruby and the boys, and I probably watched more jumps than I did flat, but I'll be
a good judge. You're a good judge, Charlie. You're a good judge.
Right. These will be short and sharp, and gut reaction, please. Okay. First of all, Charlie Nicholas, would you happily sacrifice 10 titles in a row at Celtic to see Scotland make it out of the group stage of the Euros?
No.
Right. Wenger or Graham, who was the better Arsenal manager?
Wenger.
Whose result do you look for first, Celtic or Arsenal?
Celtic.
Okay.
Charlie.
Yeah, I expected all of those, to be fair, after the interview. Charlie, you're off the hook. Thank you so much. That was a brilliant, great chat. Jeez, it was as easy as it could be, just chatting. You could sit, listen here, listen all day to you. So thank you very much for giving us the time, and have a great, happy new year. And hopefully 2021 will be a better year than 2020, and we'll enjoy a bit of success.
I'm sure we will. Thank you, Paddy. And Ruby, it's an absolute pleasure meeting you.
And mine, Charlie. And mine, you.
From afar for many years. I think you're an absolute credit to yourself.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlie. Thank you. And we'll catch up soon. It won't be Cheltenham, it won't be Aintree. Paddy, you'd have
hopefully
to organise
a game. Hopefully, Ireland.
We'll get it over to Leopardstown at the end of the season, maybe next year.
That'd be perfect.
Brilliant. Thank you, guys.
Thanks a million.
Cheers, Charlie.
Cheers, Charlie.
Righto, that's all we've got time for on today's show. My thanks to Paddy, Ruby, and our special guest, Mr. Charlie Nicholas. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. Make sure you're subscribed to the show. We're back on Friday with tips for the weekend in the company of Mr. Francis Hickey. But between now and then, I've been Tom Nugent, and that was From the Horse's Mouth. Paddy, did you notice the way he said it wasn't a pleasure to meet you or anything? Did you cop that, did you?